namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi。 I'm thinking of the word discernment. Being a fellow who gives these talks a lot, I do think about words. And words are just representations. So I could say there's a mallard duck meditating and incubating eggs just behind the workshop. So that's all a representation, isn't it? Mallard duck. Peter cut down the dead elm there by the workshop, which was very dramatic. Almost lost Peter, the workshop, and the electrics.
Yeah.
But then right behind the tree, which is behind that dead elm, there's a nest with 12 eggs. And Madame Mallard sitting on them. And that's all a representation, isn't it? It's just the way we communicate. Mallard duck. So if you're from somewhere else where they don't have mallard ducks, you don't know what it is. So language is just representation. It's always important to remember that our use of language isn't absolute. There isn't just kind of one right word for life's experiences. So in listening to Dhamma, certainly you need some faith that the speaker has some knowledge of the topic, has something to offer. If you have no faith at all, then of course you probably wouldn't be here. But having some faith, then one, as Lompo Cha would say, one listens with the heart rather than with the head. And listening with the head would be a kind of constant critique. Well, is that according to the scriptures, or this teacher doesn't say that? It's a kind of constant muttering in the mind of one's own opinions and views about what's being said. And that, sometimes people listen that way, but listening with the heart is more trying to say, okay, this person wants to express something, and they might have some information which would be helpful for me to take in. And what are they trying to convey? What are they trying to say in these words? And I might use the words differently than you, and you might use different words differently than me. But it's not just about the words, because they're the representations, aren't they? And sometimes you see that in Buddhism, or any endeavor where people argue about the words. No, that's you can't say it that way and miss where they say the finger pointing to the moon. Look at the moon, don't worry about the finger. So in English now, one of the words you find a lot in the translations of Buddhist ideas is the word discernment. And when you think about it, you have like discernment, criticism, judgment, opinion, intelligence, wisdom, intuition. You have a whole range of words there that are meaningful to each of us in different ways, and some of those meanings we feel the same about. But like if we say like critical, you can say this person is very critical, so that's usually a kind of pejorative thing, right? Or this piece of information is critical, I really need that piece of information. Or the person is in critical care. So just that one word has sort of many flavors to it. Judgment. In my judgment, we should go right. Don't judge me. Stop judging me. Judgment itself. Kind of different ways that we read that. Intelligence. Intelligence and wisdom. You find that in Buddhist texts. Wisdom. What's intelligence? What's wisdom? Sometimes we like people say, I shouldn't be so critical, I shouldn't be so judgmental, and yet just to throw out the critical faculty, a critical analysis, that's not necessarily wrong. So the word discernment, the way I use that word, and you check it out for yourself what word you might use, is that, say, if I'm observing the in and out breathing, let's say, of the body, so I decided just settle the mind with the breath, that faculty that knows the difference between the feeling, the registered feeling, the physical sensation of an in-breath, and the difference between an in-breath and an out-breath, the physical sensation, that I consider to be discernment. Because if you're observing the breath, you're not making a critique of the breath. You might be, you say, oh, I'm breathing too fast or I'm breathing too slow. You might do a critique of it, but discernment to me seems to be very, very, very neutral. It's not judging it in any kind of way that it's good or bad. It's just knowing that right now, the in-breath, the breath feels this way. Let's say if it's the in-breath, that's a representation I make. That's in-breath. And that feels different than out-breath. They're different, aren't they? And that's discernment. For me, you use your word. But there is that, right? So, again, don't worry about the words. What is that faculty? What is that ability? And that's a very, very important ability we have. So I can be, feeling grumpy. Maybe I've got the flu and haven't had enough coffee or something significant like that. And then I look at someone in the monastery and I start to feel critical of them. Well, why don't they do this and why don't they do that? I can discern that my mind is producing a critical representation of the world, right? I can discern that. So it's a kind of metacognition of something bigger than just the simple mood that I'm in and the kind of mindsets that this mood is creating, producing. And that seems to me crucial for freedom. If you don't have discernment, you just tend to be lost in whatever the primary functioning is. I'm lost in the criticism, I'm lost in the judgment, I'm lost in the whatever it is. So discernment is that capacity to know what's going on in a very, actually it's a very equanimous way. And from that we can work. If we don't have discernment, then we tend to react, just tend to be caught up in habits. So one of the primary practices in Buddhism is, and these are kind of clumsy combinations sometimes, but awakened discernment, if you want to say it that way, awakened discernment, and that's a dynamic, isn't it? It's not a position. It's not an opinion. Discernment is an opinion. When I feel the entire in breath, it's something that's changing, and then I see it change from in to out. I'm discerning a process, a changing thing. It's not a fixed position. It's not an ideal. It's not a judgment. And it's not a representation. The language afterwards is a representation, but it's the immediate experience of that, immediate knowing of it. So I'm on an emotional, mental level, I'm feeling sick, the flu-ish and so on, and my mind produces a kind of critical judgment of the world, and I discern that. And if I've got any kind of awareness and experience, I said, don't believe it. Just don't go there. So the discernment helps me to make choices. If I don't have the discernment, how am I going to make choices? Yeah, I think that's obvious. But sometimes we don't. It's so simple. Discernment's so simple. We don't actually see, or we don't. We don't enact it. Maybe we just kind of get caught up with life. So what we're trying to do in Buddha's daily life practice is cultivate awakened discernment constantly. What's going on? How is it for you? How does it feel? Da-da-da. The last time I was here, 2 weeks ago, I think we were talking about eggs. We talked about the nature of frying an egg, but What I was thinking about was how we learn and the nature of doing things. So like yesterday, Venerable Kemiko showed me how to use the bandsaw. Bandsaw is a saw that has a band, which is a saw blade, and it runs around, and it's a brilliant machine for milling wood. So what did I have to do that? I had to humble myself to Venerable Kemiko. I couldn't just say, I'm the abbot, I know everything. No way, Jose, you don't know. So I had to humble myself, not in a perverse way, but just, Venerable Kemiko, can you show me the bandsaw? And so we went in, and then he's a very good teacher, and then he showed me how to put a new blade on, showed me how to tension it, showed me how to get the drift right, showed me how to position the blade in terms of the stoppers that hold it, how high to set the open blade length, and so on and so forth. And it was a really interesting lesson in bandsaws. But what did I have to do? And I was talking about this 2 weeks ago. What did I have to do in order to use the bandsaw? Then, to use the bandsaw, I need to give up to its physics, to the laws of bandsaws. I have to give myself to the nature of the bandsaw, not to the nature of my desires. I might desire to get a nice milled piece of wood, but I can't just do it willfully and ignore the bandsaw in some kind of way. I just push my piece of wood in there and hope, voila. I can't do that. I'm junior to the bandsaw, as it were. Right? And that's how we will learn. That's how we learn about anything. You're junior to the egg. But once you understand the egg and the heat of the pan and the oil and all of that, you can do wonderful things. You can cook. And the same with the bandsaw, say. Having shown me how to do that, and then I played around with it, well, at the same time, Peter was taking down the elm tree. And you notice we have a lot of dead trees around. These are elms, which we think probably have the Dutch elm disease. They die after maybe 20 or 30 years. And so they're being taken out. So when Peter dropped the tree and then he chopped it up into firewood bits, then I had a look. I said, I can mill that. So I took a piece of, maybe 14-inch log, and I took it up to the bandsaw, and I milled it. And then I used a jointer and other machines, and a nice piece of wood. And so by humbling myself to Venerable Kemiko and giving myself to the nature of the bandsaw, I then have potential. I have potential to be creative and to make things and have a certain amount of a joy in that. And that way of learning, where we have to give ourselves to something, is really the way of learning about your heart, about your mind. And it's not about being critical all the time. It's about being discerning. Discernment is different. It's not. It's just seeing, what is the nature of emotion, rather than I shouldn't have these emotions? What is the nature of the body, rather than, oh, I wish the body was younger? Or what is the nature of aging? Or what is the nature of whatever it is? That's using awareing, it's even more clumsy, awareing discernment, an awakened discernment of, well, what is the nature of this situation? So if we use the critical mind all the time around the way things are, we're not going to understand the way things are, because we haven't really kind of given up to the way things are from which learning can take place. So for me, discernment and a kind of jaundiced criticism is different. For all of us, it's different. So we have, like this year, we have a lot of tree cutting to do. So you know the big trees that run to the fence line behind the Buddha, I think they're firs, are they? Anyone? Firs? Spruces? Spruces, okay, they're spruces, but they're six spruces. It's not a species. They're dying, right? And if you look at them, you see only the tops are alive. And they have a fungus. And we've talked to arborists for 5 years now. And finally, we're going to try to take them out, which is quite a task. And so on and so forth. But yeah, you imagine someone drives into the monastery. And they're not really discerning. They're not an arborist. But they've sort of noticed that there's a line of trees there. And they're kind of crawl up in their private lives and they're, oh, nice trees, look, and then whatever, talking about themselves. And they come back 4 weeks later and all the trees are gone. And they write me a letter saying, you fool, you're destroying the planet. I no longer will support this monastery. And at the bottom it said, with metta. And that's a person that's critical but not discerning, right? And that lack of discernment is what we call ignorance, avijja, not knowing the way things are. Oh, and in our Pali chanting, avijja paccaya sankhara, with ignorance as condition, the whole mess of old age, sickness and death follows and suffering. And ignorance isn't like a kind of lack of IQ, it's a lack of attentiveness to the way things are. And hence the... Because of that lack of attentiveness, one jumps to conclusions, one's been biased by whatever cultural family stuff, and then one makes runs around in this world in a suffering way because of ignorance, because of not seeing clearly, because of a lack of discernment. When I think of the Buddha and his teachings, I was pondering this, that for me the Buddha isn't a kind of abstract philosopher, obviously a fabulous being, and where he was at, I have no idea. So, but my sense of him is that he's more like a car mechanic than an abstract philosopher, because what I take from Buddhism is its pragmatism, that what the Buddha offers me isn't a kind of representation theory that I have to memorize. He's saying, look at life this way. Observe this, discern that this is the way things work. And if you have those same kind of discernments, that will free you from suffering. Very pragmatic. And basically says, if you don't believe me, tough. But I suggest you go for it and try this out. So for me, he's got the pragmatism of like a car mechanic, the theoretical physicist might have lots of ideas about compression engines and da-da-da-da-da, but when it comes to fixing his own car, he might not have a clue. He goes to the car mechanic and the mechanic diagnoses it. He discerns what's wrong. He looks at it in a very pragmatic way, in a provable way, fixes it for you, and then charges you something you think is exorbitant because you think he's a tradesman and shouldn't be paid like a professional. But actually, you couldn't drive your car without him. So there's something about that pragmatism that obviously appeals to me because it works. And it's proven in the world of things. And for me, then, like the Buddhist teaching is like the Buddha has a problem. And the problem is his own suffering. And he enunciates that in a very grand way. And he says, there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless. It's not just about psychological readjustment. It's a profound searching that he's involved in. And in the searching, he is successful. And then it seems to me he kind of reverse engineers his enlightenment. And then he starts teaching. He kind of goes, and then you get this teaching coming out for the next 45 years. An analysis that is not abstract, that it's not coming from a bunch of ideas that have just been formulated in his head in some kind of representational abstract way. No, this is the proof. My realization is the proof. Now how can I set up a path for others to follow? So we pick up that, and then we try to engineer it into our own freedom, into our own enlightenment. So it's very, very pragmatic that way. So getting back to language, if you end up arguing about what a word means in terms of intellectual position, you might just be missing the whole, you know, what is that word really in my life? So to do Buddhism, well, you have to make it personal. You have to make it like looking at your own khandhas, at your own situation. And yet we say that there is no person. So that seems a real contradiction. But when we say looking at it personally, it says you have to look at your own emotions to understand the nature of emotions. You have to look at your own body to understand the nature of body. You have to look at your own social situation to understand social suffering. So ignorance then, ignorance is not seeing clearly the way things are. Discernment is seeing clearly the way things are. And the prime motivation for doing Buddhism is that we all suffer. We are built to go beyond suffering because we have desire, and desire doesn't want to suffer. It's an energy which doesn't want to suffer. So biologically, obviously, but also psychologically, but more than that, as humans, there seems to be a kind of capacity for some kind of deeper transcendent realization, a hunger for that even, that we humans, some of us, are interested, are passionate about, have an intuition of, think it's possible. So when we hear the Buddha's his realization, we say, well, okay, I'd like to do that. Or when we meet someone like Ajahn Chah, yeah, that's worthy. I'd like to give that a go. It's like seeing a beautiful piece of turned wood. You know, someone who's really made some beautiful furniture. You think, well, that's really lovely. I'd like to do that myself. I wonder how I could do that. Same with us. And you see something really beautiful in humanity, and you think, yeah, that's worthy of respect. And then you go to that person. You see, how do you manage to stay so equanimous? Or how come you don't have road rage? My brother was just in India, and he can't figure out how people in India don't have road rage. He says, how do they do it? So we see in others, or we read in books, we see, yeah, there is this possibility in human functioning, in human flourishing of like the Dalai Lama. You see someone like that. You meet him, and you talk with him, and you see him operating in the most complex social situation you can imagine. Constant refugees coming from over the borders of China, Tibet, into Dharamsala, and being a kind of mega rock star religious leader. And just, can you imagine how complicated his life is? And he's just radiant. The times I've met him. And you see that, and you think, how did he do that? I'd like a bit of that action. And that's the sort of human example, rather than example in craft. It's the human craft of developing the heart in a way which is meaningful and gives meaning to our lives, doesn't it? Gives meaning to this life. But it begins by discernment. And the discernment is very much, first of all, by learning to settle the mind with discernment and awareness. So when we do something like Anapanasati, or Sound of Silence, or Metta Bhavana, or whatever practices of settling you like to do, it's not just about the breath or whatever, it's actually cultivating these two factors, awakened discernment. Because when I am able to be with 100 breaths, say, fairly consistently, fairly settled, what have I done? I've not only calmed the mind down, which is great, which is important, but I've made these two faculties, awareness and discernment, I've made them stronger in my mind. I've done the kind of workout that I need. And we all find that when you enter into more complex things, all of a sudden discernment notices that I'm getting uptight. Or discernment notices, well, I didn't react this time. Oh, look at that. So they're very important. That's why it's so important to cultivate times of deliberate meditative development, to develop these forces and strengths in consciousness, which then come into play when we have more complex situations. But if we haven't really worked on that and developed that, then quite often we sort of get overwhelmed, survive, and try to run away from that complexity again. As opposed to then, like when you have these strengths, like discernment, and your mind starts to react, and you now have the strength, you see that reaction coming up, and you discern it's arising. You see, oh, there's a reaction arising. And that's not a critical judgment, that one shouldn't feel that way. It's just, oh, this has arisen now. This is beginning. This is influencing my perceptions. This is influencing the way I'm interpreting life. And having suffered through maybe that particular reaction, then we can make choices. And the choices now are driven by discernment and experience and wisdom and insight, rather than driven by habitual reactions. And then those choices around right speech, right action, and some sense of care for the mind, give us a kind of creative possibility. Give us a possibility of going a different direction than just that old reactive habit that we've had. And if for some reason we don't understand these kind of reactive habits, then it's kind of like me humbling myself to the laws of the bandsaw. I have to understand the bandsaw. I can't just demand that it does what I want before it can perform. In the same way, in our own consciousness, our own emotional stuff, or our interactions with our parents, or our kids, or our fellow workers, or whatever, if there's like constantly not understanding why there's so much suffering here or conflict, what is it about the heart which can't be discerning and at peace, then it's rather like, okay, I have to learn from this. I have to give myself to this suffering, to this situation of confusion, not abjectly in a kind of, oh, it's my fate, it's my karma to be stupid, that's not it, but rather to say, I don't understand. What is it? What is it about this person or this situation that gets me so upset? And that's discernment. That's kind of going back to discernment. Say, well, what is it? What is it? And that's a kind of willingness to suffer. You know, willingness to feel life's conflicts, to like willingness to be with some difficulty in life, rather than just demanding that life be different. And then our learning is, well, emotion life is emotional. It is, you know, emotions are not rational. So if I feel emotional about something, well, why not? Why shouldn't I feel emotional about something if my buttons get pressed? It's all right. But my critical mind might say, I shouldn't feel these emotions around this situation now. But what is the nature of my mind and body? What is the nature of this being? And the nature of this being is that, like, I like comfort, I dislike discomfort. Natural. So I feel discomfort psychologically, physically, environmentally. I don't want it to be that way. I want to change it. Right? Maybe I can't do anything about it. Socially, I feel uncomfortable with a person. Now, if I'm discerning that, you know, I meet a person, I feel very uncomfortable with them. I can know that, oh, being with this person feels uncomfortable. And that makes actually very peaceful. Right? It's not demanding that they be different or that I somehow am really cool with them. It's just, I feel really uncomfortable with this person. And that discernment is not the discomfort, isn't it? It's the way of awareness and awakening. So sometimes, like here, we have people who are like socially awkward, you know, who just, it's a very different kind of situation. And maybe they live alone and they come here and you can feel their kind of social awkwardness. They don't know what to do. And then I'm foolish enough to ask them a question. They feel even more frightened in front of the group, right? And so I've noticed that if that person feels frightened, then I feel uncomfortable, right? And if I'm not aware of that, then my discomfort feeds their discomfort. They see that I'm discomfort, and we create each other. Two discomforts. Trying to relate to each other. But if I discern, there's not only this person, but there's this reaction, and we all do this, don't we? Otherwise we'd be in an institution, I think. But if I notice that reaction, oh, this feels, this, you know, I'm feeling anxious because it's like socially awkward, and I wait with that, and I just let that be, there's more chance that this person will feel less socially awkward because I haven't reacted in that way that, you know, and it's okay. Why should they be different? This is just the way it is now. And morally, if they, you know, if they start to shoot up heroin in the shrine room, I'd probably say something. No, we don't do that. Or do something very, very immoral. But the way of nature is that our world presents itself in a particular way, and it is as it is. It's just, you know, it's rain is rain, and fog is fog, and sun is sun, and spring is spring, and winter is winter. And just discerning that winter feels cold, and then seeing maybe what I add to that, oh great, it's cold, or oh gosh, it's winter again. Can you imagine if we had a frost now? Or like a snowfall. We've had snowfalls in June, haven't we? Anyway, let's say you get a snowfall in May, right? And it's dark. Yeah, my emotional reaction would be definitely go away. And I could see, oh, the snow is this thing, but my reaction is another thing. It's something that is okay, nothing wrong with it. And if I can see the arising of the reaction, I'll also begin to see its cessation. I'll see it as an object. I can see with arising, there is ceasing. And cessation is something that we always emphasize a lot in Buddhism, is not the ending of a condition, the ending of a reaction, say in this case, is very, very important. Because we see that that reaction is not a fixed reality, but it's actually just a particular perception, interpretation of the way it is now. And as we see the ceasing of things, we see that in that ceasing, in the non-adding, of not adding to anything there, we begin to be at peace with the way things are. And cessation is very important. And the way we talk about cessation is that what's particularly very important in understanding the mind is that the arising of thought, the arising of a sense of self, is simply an object in consciousness. It is a thought, it's an emotional formation, it's a perception. It arises, it interprets life through that. And if you're really practicing clear discernment, then you'll notice that when that thought ends, when that is allowed to end, and you just discern this is the ending, you'll notice that the sense of self is also ceasing. It's also ending. And in that ending, you begin to find peace. Not in trying to end it through a willful act of suppression or whatever, or a willful distraction, but in the patient discernment that which arises ceases. And once you begin to see cessation, you see how the sense of self does cease, and what's left is actually clarity, discernment, functioning, quite good, but the mind is at peace because the mind hasn't got the rattling on of ego, the rattling on of desire. And desire is really what the Buddha pointed to as being the problem, that when we don't understand desire as a natural function, when we don't discern desire and its limits, not get rid of it, when we don't know that how desire creates a sense of a self, attachment to desire, creates ego, then we don't know that patterning, then we're forever enslaved to it, and that's ignorance. So someone feels awkward in the monastery, and I feel awkward, and then my awkwardness creates a kind of desire. I don't want awkwardness. I don't want this awkwardness, and this awkwardness is your fault. It's your fault that I'm feeling awkward. You change. You change so that I don't feel awkward. And that's desire. And desire comes up, and then I start to think in ways, how can I manipulate, control, or get rid of you so that I don't feel awkward? And that's a thought pattern. And that's based on aversion and a desire that a person be different than they are. And then, of course, that creates me and creates them, sense of self. And if I have no discernment, then that becomes my relationship to this person, one of alienation. But if I notice that this awkwardness comes up, and I notice that it's something that wasn't there before, so it's not a fixed piece of furniture, you know, it's something that's come into consciousness, and then I notice how my thinking mind wants to create a person around it, you shouldn't be like that, or I shouldn't be like that, and I just wait it out, and then I wait it out, and then it ends, the thinking ends, and the awkwardness is still there as a perception, but that begins to end, and that's peace. That's peace. Not because all of a sudden this person has changed in their social functioning or that I'm somehow never feeling awkward, but because I haven't attached. That's non-attaching. It's non-grasping. Things arise and cease. And this ceasing is something that you need to note. So in the Third Noble Truth, you say, realize cessation. Realize when a thought has ended. You let that be. This is very important in meditation, because what you'll find is in you find yourself thinking, okay? Then you'll think you're thinking, then right away you'll try to get rid of your thoughts. That's all sense of self. Whereas if you notice that thinking has arisen, you'll also notice that thinking has ceased, and you'll see that the discernment of that, the awareness of that, is beyond thought. Deeper than thought, and that's where peace lies. Very important. And so look at, like in your meditation, really look carefully at how thinking arises and ceases, rather than try to not think. That's the key to getting into the peace of the mind. If you try to not think, you're still the person who thinks they're producing thoughts. And as I've been saying recently, if you're the thinker, then stop thinking. If you think you're thinking, then stop thinking. But you're not the thinker. Thinking comes up because of causes and conditions. Sure. So I've been playing with a bandsaw. Guess what I'm thinking about? Elm trees and bandsaws. What else would I be thinking about? Well, Buddhism would be good, wouldn't it? But so I can see the thought of elm trees and wood and bandsaw is conditioned by my interest in that. And if I'm meditating, if I try to get rid of those thoughts, stop thinking, then there's just a me and this struggle to get rid of, and it's aversion. But if there's discernment, no, thoughts have arisen, and then I just wait. Because as soon as I notice that thoughts have arisen, they've actually ceased. That's the moment of cessation. And I just allow myself, discernment is like, it's feeling this way now. If I'm attentive, you see the silence of the mind, the end of thought. And that's the entryway. You know, once you get that, your meditation really moves very nicely. But as long as there's this belief in thought, trying to get rid of thought, and not the realization of that space or that gap, and these gaps are infinitesimal. They're no big deal, we don't notice them. But if once you start to get your nose into those gaps, you start to smell fresh air, rather than kind of stagnant, stale stuff of habitual thinking. And how much of our thinking is just stagnant, habitual patterns of complaining about something, or being down on yourself, or worrying. You know, it's just like kind of karmic patterns. And yet, within all of that, there are gaps. There are these infinitesimal spaces of peace and not-self. There's no person in that. There's still functioning. There's still discernment. There's still clarity. So consider when you are, you know, when you're meditating and you're taking your object of meditation, look at what discernment is. Get to kind of, oh yeah, that's what he means. And use a different word if you want. I'm easy, of course. But get a feeling of that faculty of just knowing. The in-breath feels this way, and it feels different than the out-breath. There's a difference. What is that? And it's not the breath. It's the discerning faculty. And then that, you try to, oh yeah, that's why we do anapanasati, not to suppress thought. It settles the mind, but also it develops this discernment. And then if you understand that, you'll find that functioning in ordinary life more and more, functioning and helping you. I mean, that's the real wisdom teaching. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.